It was not until I moved to Pittsburgh in 2010 that I'd ever heard of a wedding cookie table. I mean, where I came from in Virginia, punch and cake receptions were common, or pig pickings at a local park after the ceremony. Sometimes receptions would just have enough appetizers to count for dinner, but cookies were for Christmas and not for weddings. So when two of Edwin's students got married after his first year teaching over at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary and invited us to the wedding, and I saw this massive table under its own tent, reception was in the bride's parents' yard, this massive table full of cookies, I had no idea quite what to do. I did not know quite what to do. I mean, there was every kind of cookie imaginable, sugar cookies, ginger snaps, pecan logs, those little, to look like peaches. But in addition to the sheer variety, I was stunned to see that, first of all, the guests were going and eating from the cookies before dinner was served. And secondly, they also seemed to be carrying around to-go boxes. I mean, I remember looking at this and thinking, who does that? I mean, isn't it sort of gauche or impolite to like bring a to-go box to somebody's wedding reception and take their food away? Like, you know, how is that ever done? Then I discovered in walking to the other side of the big table on the tent that the to-go boxes were just there and you were supposed to take them and supposed to fill up and, I don't know, eat your way in cookies to dinner and then maybe take some extras home for your kids. That you'd left behind. Now I will say, in the 12 years that I've now lived in Western Pennsylvania, let me tell you, I think this is great. And my kids are completely planning on, no matter where they live, that they are going to have cookie tables at their wedding receptions. They make an excellent hors d'oeuvre and a wedding favor when you take them home in a to-go box. There is nothing like a wedding to show off a region's culture and customs. Nothing like a wedding to demonstrate how cultures of all kinds have rules, unwritten norms that tell us how we should act and how we should expect. But the thing is that many of our rules are hidden from us until circumstances jolt you right into awareness of what they are, as in standing in front of a cookie table with to-go boxes thinking, who does this? You don't even know the rules you're playing by until that moment when you've discovered that you're feeling judgmental of others just simply because you didn't understand that you had rules and you're in a different place than you were before. How about this rule? Everyone serves the good wine first and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you've kept the good wine until now. So says the chief steward to the bridegroom in the story today from John's Gospel. Everybody knows, or I should say everybody knew in that day, that there was an order to the wine service at a wedding. First, you serve the limited edition red that has notes of blackberry and chocolate with a bit of a peppery finish. And then as the evening wears on, you can move on to the Bordeaux box. And if the guests are still going the next morning, then you can offer up the boons. But Jesus flips the script. The wine that he makes is a prize-worthy vintage. And his first sign, his first miracle, is wine that is generous in quantity and amazing in quality. Generous in quantity and amazing in quality. The party is saved, his mother is mollified, his disciples believe in him, and even though Jesus' hour has not yet come, all of us get an amazing foretaste of the grace that will spill through him into the world. But there's one person in the story who's not quite in on the miracle. And that's the chief steward, or in Greek, the boss of the dining room. Chief sommelier, you might say, master of the waiters, or master of the house. He's the boss of all the other servants and the one who is charged with making sure that things go well and according to custom. We have no idea what tone he used when he approached the bridegroom to ask about this amazing wine, but I have to wonder whether his sensibilities weren't just a little offended by the turn of events that meant that the good wine was being served last. John tells us that this chief steward did not know where the wine had come from. And John's also very careful to tell us that the servants, the regular workers, the underlings, were completely aware of who'd brought the remarkable vintage. It's almost as if the gospel wants us to know that those who are in charge, those who know the rules, don't always know everything. It's as if the gospel wants us to imagine that there could be a scenario in which the last know more than the first, and the first will have to come behind in their knowledge behind the last. It's as if the gospel wants us to know that if you really want to be in on what God is doing, you have to let go of your expectations and your customs and your rules just a little bit. It's as if the gospel wants us to know that it's sometimes good to be in the servant's position. It's as if the gospel wants us to know that the gospel isn't what everybody knows. Jesus' own self-giving for the life of the world doesn't conform to custom or expectation. His grace isn't obedient to norms. It's big enough, broad enough, wide enough to make space for new and unusual ways of doing things. Jesus comes a human being like us, but he also makes us question whether the way we always do things is the way we have to do them. And his self-giving love is so spacious and so abundant that it creates space in us to allow others to show us how they do things. It's a paradox, this gift of wine. His love for us will come to us just as we are, freely, apart from our works. And at the same time, it'll make us humble about who we are and more open to others who are loved just as much. Every year during December, and I know this is a few weeks late, but go with me here. Every year during December, the Lutheran World Federation, which is the worldwide community of Lutheran churches from every part of the globe, every year the Lutheran World Federation hosts online what they call a singing communion of churches. And these churches in different countries submit videos of a Christmas or an Advent song, or sometimes just simply a Christian song, a hymn, that is important in their home Lutheran church context. Watching the videos is a great way to learn how global our church really is, and that there's not just one way of being Lutheran. When I was watching some of the videos this year, I was initially surprised to see that it's some of the poorer countries, or countries that I imagined to be poorer, that have fewer resources than, say, the United States does, that they were some of the ones that were submitting the most sophisticated videos, a la MTV quality, for those of you who are from that generation. Like my experience in front of a Pittsburgh wedding cookie table, this was a lesson in cultural humility. For it's some of those countries, Malawi and Madagascar, where the Lutheran Church is growing and where it's young. And of course, young people can do amazing things with just one phone. If you imagine Lutheranism to be primarily Scandinavian or German or North American, the whole website is an education, and I encourage you to Google it. It's good, rich stuff and a window into God's abundance. In North America, I reflected, we often think that the wine is running out, that people are less interested in church and God than they ever were. And in many of our experiences here, that's true. But in other places across the globe, the church is growing. It's catching fire. And I wonder what we could learn from those sister churches if we changed our mindset a little bit. Because for far too often, we've thought of churches in poorer countries as people we need to help. But what if we need their help? And what if we could receive that if we change our way of thinking and our expectations, if we stand back and allow for some space so that God's abundance, the grace that God is still pouring into the world richly and wondrously, amazingly, can capture our imaginations as well. At that wedding, I imagine the chief steward had his own death and resurrection moment, a moment when he had to learn that he was not in charge. For the real role of chief steward, the true head of the dining room, the lord of the servants, that was not his role to claim. That position belonged to another, who'd been invited as a guest, and yet who gave more than anyone could ever imagine. Those who've tasted the wine that he brings are pleased to take their role as mere servants, and delighted to discover that good wine can be served whenever Jesus offers it. Amen. Thank you.